Welcome to this week's episode of The Read Out Loud, a weekly biotech podcast from STAT. I'm Damian Garde, recording from STAT's New York City Bureau.
I'm Adam Feuerstein, here in STAT's worldwide headquarters in Boston.
And I'm Rebecca Robbins, recording from STAT's San Francisco outpost.
It's Thursday, February 28th, and here's what's on the docket this week.
Seven pharma executives got grilled by lawmakers on Capitol Hill this week.
We're all trying to understand the sticker shock that many drugs generate, especially when some of these drugs have been around for a long, long time.
Our STAT colleague Matt Herper joins us to break down the closely watched congressional hearing on high drug prices.
Next, Matt will stick around to help us dissect the big M&A news of the week. The large drug maker Roche is paying $4.8 billion to take over gene therapy developer Spark Therapeutics. We'll ask, are big dollar cell and gene therapy acquisitions like this one going to pay off?
Biotech startups shout from the rooftops when they raise venture capital money. Then they go quiet. Our STAT colleague, Kate Sheridan, has been looking back a year out after these fundraising announcements to track how companies actually spent their money.
And last but not least, we will bring you another lightning round, and this one will be full of hot takes on the suddenly perilous Bristol-Myers Squibb Celgene merger, a gender-related kerfuffle at a microbiome conference, and Novartis's unending headache surrounding its dealings with President Trump's former lawyer.
But first, a word from our sponsor.
This episode of The Read Out Loud is brought to you by Two Scientists Walk Into a Bar, a Genentech science podcast, where leading scientists tackle a range of hot topics, including a deep dive into the microbiome and the science behind complex diseases like cancer and asthma. Visit gene.com/podcast. That's gene.com/podcast. And subscribe to Two Scientists Walk Into a Bar wherever you get your podcasts.
Drug prices are astronomically high because that's where pharmaceutical companies and their investors want them. The brakes have come off pharmaceutical pricing, and American families are hurtling along in the passenger seat, terrified about what comes next.
That was Senator Ron Wyden, an Oregon Democrat, using some colorful imagery to explain his view of the drug industry. He was speaking at a Senate Finance Committee hearing earlier this week, in which seven pharma executives were put to task over the rising cost of medicines.
So coming into that hearing, there was a fairly widespread expectation that pharma might come out bruised and battered by angry senators from both sides of the aisle. But that's not exactly what happened.
Joining us is STAT's Matt Herper, who tuned in for all 3 hours of the hearing. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So Matt, big picture, a lot of people expected this hearing to be the drug industry's big tobacco moment. How did the seven executives hold up under Senate scrutiny?
Amazingly well. It was like watching a well-oiled soccer team. I mean, they really had this down to the extent that you can have going in front of Congress and being grilled down. And you even left out the best part of Ron Wyden's speech, which is when he compared AbbVie and by extension its chief executive, who was sitting there, to Gollum from Lord of the Rings.
Over 6 years, the company doubled the price of a 12-month supply from $19,000 to $38,000. Can the patients opt for a less expensive alternative? They can't, because AbbVie protects the exclusivity of Humira like Gollum with his ring.
So there was some heat, but they'd figured out what their concessions were. They made them. They didn't budge any further. And they did a pretty good job, it seemed like, of complicating the simple, of making it difficult to just say, well, you guys raise prices and it's terrible. And they committed that if the system changed, they would lower prices.
To your point about complicating the simple, a lot of the discussion eventually turned to the difference between list prices and net prices.
It's like all we ever talk about.
Exactly, yes. And that's the difference between the sticker cost of a drug and the amount that the manufacturers actually get after rebates and discounts. So we kind of got mired in that in the hearing, which was unsurprising. And we've heard a lot of this stuff before. But Matt, I was curious, was there anything said at the hearing that you hadn't heard before or that surprised you that a drug company executive was willing to divulge or willing to commit to?
A few things. The support of the CREATES Act and the unanimity that they went in there saying, we want this act, which has some stipulations that will make things a little tougher for drug companies. They all just were behind that. More than that, starting with Pascal Soriot, but some of the other executives said it maybe less clearly, they were committed that if the rebate system changed, they would lower list prices.
So you alluded to that blame game as to who's at fault for high drug costs. And before the hearing, Republican Senator Chuck Grassley tweeted, quote, "I hope the drug company CEOs testifying tomorrow don't try to blame everyone but themselves / take no responsibility for their role in fixing the problem," end quote. So Matt, is that how things played out?
I think the executives knew that they had to come with some concessions, and I think they probably made enough that they left a good number of the senators on the Finance Committee feeling as if they were cooperating.
So winners and losers, who do we think came out the best and who do we think came out the worst from the hearing?
Well, look, the loser were the ones who weren't there. They were the PBMs. Of the executives sitting there, Rick Gonzalez probably took the heaviest beating. And Jennifer Taubert from Johnson & Johnson, who was the non-CEO on the panel, got hit pretty hard on a question that came out of left field from Senator Hassan from New Hampshire about opioids. They really did get roughed up a bit, but still, I think, less than people expected.
So we all remember Martin Shkreli's sort of iconic smirk when he testified before Congress a few years back. What was the most memorable exchange or moment from the hearing? You know, something we might hear soundbited for the rest of the year.
Less for a soundbite, actually, but Ken Frazier from Merck is the anti-Martin Shkreli. He is a calm, collected lawyer, really seems conversational when he's talking, can become very passionate without going overboard. And he really did direct a lot of the discussion, and he was able to push back several times against the senators. And I think that's something I remember. The sound bites were the things that Wyden said, which were all fantastic. I don't know that there was another moment like that that sticks out in my head as a quote, which is partly what we mean when we say the pharma executives did well, because their goal had to be not to have a soundbite that would be played again and again and again.
Yeah, I was thinking, honestly, the damning soundbites came not from the executives themselves, but arguably from the senators. You mentioned Hassan's questioning about opioids, but it felt misdirected, considering that Johnson & Johnson doesn't market any opioids. And
oh, but they did. Like, that was her point. I mean, we go back far enough, Johnson & Johnson invented fentanyl.
In the moment, though, I don't know, for some reason, it just felt like a very, very heavy blow that wasn't totally landing. And anyway, for me, the most memorable soundbite by far was Chuck Grassley butchering the pronunciation of the names when introducing the panel of executives.
The first witness is Richard Gonzalez.
That was a very homespun moment. As a name butcherer, I appreciated it.
Do we think that this hearing will have any lasting effect on the world, whether on, you know, future pricing legislation, the view of the industry, the cultural zeitgeist around pharma? Did this mean anything?
I think it means a lot in terms of this overall story that it seems like some things may actually happen with regard to how the U.S. drug pricing system is set up. I don't know that it made that much of a cultural impact, especially coming a day before Michael Cohen, right? This had never happened before. You'd never had big pharma CEOs called to the carpet in the Senate like this before. It's going to have an effect, but a lot less of one than if this had been front page news and there'd been circus.
Matt, thanks for sharing your observations on the hearing. And fans of Matt Herper will be happy to know he'll stick around for our next segment, too.
This week delivered another big biotech acquisition. Roche, the Swiss pharma giant, announced a deal in which it will spend $4.8 billion to acquire Spark Therapeutics.
Yeah, and so there are two pretty clear and important themes, I think, that emerged from this deal. The first one being that very large pharma companies and biotech companies are ready and eager and willing to spend lots of money to bolster those drug pipelines and stave off patent expirations and basically stay alive. The second thing is that smaller biotechs like Spark that are developing gene and cell therapies seem to have become the most attractive acquisition targets for deals like that.
So Matt joins us again to discuss all this. Matt, you know, quantify this recent biotech boom. You know, it seems like large pharma and biotech are not only spending billions on new acquisitions, but they're also willing to do so at breathtaking premiums.
The premiums go from big to breathtaking. I mean, you've got things where a non-cell gene therapy company, GSK, bought Tesaro. That was about a 60% premium. The last big gene therapy deal where Novartis bought AveXis, that was something like an 80% premium. Roche buying Spark is 150% premium. And one thing that's really striking is that with Roche and Spark, Roche is entering a really competitive area of gene therapy, hemophilia. Whereas, for instance, with that Novartis AveXis deal, that therapy really showed dramatic results and is kind of the only one out there. So there seems to be a feeling in big pharma boardrooms that you want to own a piece of this new gene therapy market, even though there are really no sales to speak of yet.
Well, and Adam, yeah, the preponderance of gene and cell therapies getting the largest premiums being the biggest deals, that's interesting in that, like, this is pretty newfangled technology, right? Like, these are risky investments.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you can safely conclude, you know, that after what seems like decades of question marks, gene and cell therapies have arrived. You know, the science kind of has advanced to the point where it's now rather accepted that these new medicines are capable of curing rare inherited diseases, and big pharma is really no longer content to sit on the sidelines.
Yes, and well, Spark developed the first gene therapy to treat a rare form of blindness. And it's working on a second gene therapy to treat hemophilia. But part of what Roche is getting is, well, really Kathy High, who's the scientific founder there, but kind of the idea that you're buying a platform of people and viruses, which are how you get genes into people when you're doing gene therapy, that you can use to create new therapies. And that's also why Gilead bought Kite and Celgene bought Juno, and Novartis originally licensed the CAR T technology from Penn.
And of course, we should note that there are risks to this strategy. You know, as noted by Andy Biotech, that famous biotech Twitter genius, you know, large cap biopharma has spent around $36 billion in the past 2 years for what he called, quote, shiny, sexy cell and gene therapy, end quote. But it's also noteworthy that none of these deals have yet generated much in the way of positive returns. So, Damien, what do you think about that?
I think it's a totally fair observation, and it's objectively true. It's also, it would be fair to say that a lot of these major investments are young. Celgene buying Juno, CAR T, as we mentioned, is a fairly newfangled technology. Juno is not winning the CAR T race, but also, you know, the people who aren't exactly raking in money either. So it's early days yet, I think, to judge these as businesses because of the early stages of the science behind them. One thing that I think is interesting, though, is, as Matt said, the preponderance of deals seems to suggest that the major drug makers look at cell and gene therapy as like armaments that they have to own. If you want to be a serious contender, you got to have a gene therapy, whatever. But I'm curious what you guys think. Would the science be better served if the likes of Juno or Spark had stayed independent and retained that like entrepreneurial like joie de vivre or whatever? Or is it better that they get enveloped by the likes of Roche and Novartis?
Well, maybe not, because what seems to be happening is that the guys from Juno went and raised a lot more money and started another company. The guys from Kite raised a lot more money and started another company. Novartis bought Carl June's first CAR T, but now he's at this new company, Teamunity. I mean, given the way that these deals seem to beget more venture capital, you're probably getting more R&D investment by having the buyouts happen. And the other thing we just got to remember is that these things don't always work. I mean, we've seen some significant setbacks recently from Solid Biosciences and Sangamo Therapeutics.
So looking forward then, considering all of the above context, can we expect more of these kind of acquisitions of gene and cell therapy companies?
You know, there's nothing that excites biotech investors more than the announcement of big acquisitions. You know, after that Roche Spark deal was announced on Monday, biotech investor Brad Loncar, you know, he basically couldn't contain himself on Twitter. You know, the man was practically giddy. And that sentiment was shared fairly widely. On the other side, I think it's nearly impossible to predict who gets bought and who doesn't. You know, file this under maybe like good problems to have, but there are dozens of gene and cell therapy companies out there now. And, you know, if I'm going to be the bearer of bad news here, I'll tell you that they're not all going to get acquired. In terms of premiums and valuations, you know, I say that there's probably a limit to their generosity. Let's take Sarepta Therapeutics, for example. You know, this week they showed some more positive, encouraging data on a second gene therapy, you know, and that company is executing almost to perfection, but they're also valued now at nearly $11 billion. So if we apply these kind of 100% plus premiums to takeouts, you know, Sarepta's acquisition price is going to top $20 billion. You know, that is a lot of money, even for pharma. So, you know, I kind of offer these cautious words, you know, right now about like not expecting, you know, gobs and gobs and gobs of more, you know, high premium takeouts. Of course, you know, as I say this, Sarepta will probably be acquired next week for a gazillion dollars. So, Matt, you're done this week. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys.
One of the most familiar features of biotech is the sort of happy, happy, good times press release that announces venture capital funding.
These come from startups trumpeting those millions of dollars they just raised. There are canned quotes from the CEO and the lead investor. There are references to the round being oversubscribed. Bonus points if you talk about platform technology or artificial intelligence or coming out of stealth mode.
But after all this excitement, companies go quiet for months on end, which leaves all of us wondering, what did they actually do with all that money?
Fortunately, our stat colleague, Kate Sheridan, has been doing the Lord's work by checking in on these companies. In a regular column called Something Ventured, Kate has been following up on venture fundraising announcements a year out to see how companies have actually been spending their riches.
Kate joins us today to talk about what she's learned.
Kate, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, Kate, why did you decide to start this reporting project?
Well, part of it was entirely selfish. There are just so many companies out there, and this was a good excuse for me to get some of them on my radar. But the other reason is because there does seem to be some genuine curiosity about what these companies actually do, and there is information out there.
So we'll let you get to some specific stories in a minute. But first, could we get you to reflect big picture? From doing this reporting, what have you learned about venture funding and how this business works?
I mean, a lot of venture funding trends that we anecdotally hear are true are, in fact, true. The average size of early stage rounds is going up, certainly from where it was a couple of years ago. But the one thing I've learned that might be surprising is that it's probably a bad idea to trust an early stage company's website for the most up-to-date information about its work. So far, at least two of the companies that I've covered have not updated their websites and have had some fairly substantial changes. Either they had a more developed pipeline, or they had shifted their goals a little bit. It's a better idea to talk to them and get the actual information from a person.
So, okay, one of the companies that you wrote about recently was Finch Therapeutics. They're a microbiome therapeutics company here in the Boston area. Now, they raised a bunch of money last March, but how is Finch doing today?
It didn't seem like they were doing very well. I will say the company declined to speak to me for the piece, but as I said, there is information out there. And so on Glassdoor, which, of course, is a website where employees are able to rate their experience with companies, there were several reviews that indicated there had been some layoffs happening and that the layoffs maybe didn't happen in the best way. One of the reviews said that the email kind of warning that there might be layoffs came in at 5 a.m. that day. There was one that referenced an unofficial and slightly profane company motto. It seemed like there was something going on there, and experts that I spoke to actually had no idea what it might be. One of the reviews cited challenging market conditions, but people who know what those conditions ought to be didn't quite know what to make of that.
Kate, you can't reference a slightly profane company motto and not tell us what it is.
I didn't know we were allowed to swear. The unofficial motto is we work from a-holes, not with a-holes, which references, of course, the company's fecal nature.
I see. So another company you checked in with recently was Semma Therapeutics. That's an insulin startup in Kendall Square, which raised a ton of money back in November 2017. When you last checked in on them, you learned they were experiencing some billing problems.
Yes. So as I mentioned, there is information available, and some of the databases that I checked did show that Semma had some overdue balances. But when I asked the company to explain this, they said it was nothing major. It was just that the company's clerical staff had been overwhelmed by a temporary surge in invoices, which has since been resolved. These companies are growing, so that's not necessarily surprising, but it was something that I hadn't seen with other companies before.
Of course, when doing this reporting, you haven't always found companies that look like they might be in trouble. One time you sleuthed out a startup's deluxe coffee offering. Tell us more about that.
Yes, I can say that Rios Medicines, which is based here in Cambridge, offers cold brew coffee, which they announced on a LinkedIn post. It's one of the very few public statements the company has made. Those statements include two press releases, one announcing its existence and the other announcing some new executives.
Well, we can all applaud that kind of transparency. If you have an idea for a startup that Kate should investigate for Something Ventured, you can send her a note at kate.sheridan@statnews.com.
Kate, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Next up, back by popular demand, another lightning round.
So, Damien, let's talk about this imperiled Bristol-Myers Celgene deal. What is going on?
Yes. So back in January, when Bristol-Myers Squibb announced that it was going to pay $74 billion for Celgene, the idea that shareholders might not go for that deal was a pretty fringe one. It seemed like the consensus was that this was going to go through once the time came to approve it in April. Cut to the present, Wellington, a roughly $1 trillion asset management company, publicly stated that they think buying Celgene is a really bad idea for Bristol-Myers Squibb, and then Starboard, an activist investor group, basically echoed that in a very long report issued Thursday morning. And so now, what seemed like a sure thing is arguably a little bit in doubt.
And so how much power do Wellington and Starboard actually have here?
So Wellington says it owns about an 8% stake of Bristol-Myers. That's not large enough to really bully the company, but it is large enough to give them a megaphone to shout from the mountaintops their concerns about this and conceivably convince other major shareholders to get behind them and get behind the idea of nixing the deal. And if that snowballs, then this could become a real problem for Bristol-Myers management.
It still seems like the odds are low that this deal doesn't happen, but it's peculiar in a way that, like, you know, Celgene's stock price has kind of traded at a discount basically ever since the deal was announced, which kind of tells you that, like, the market has had reservations about this deal kind of from day one.
So Novartis wasn't one of the drug companies dragged before that Senate hearing we were talking about earlier, but they got a little bit of shine in Congress regardless this week.
That's right. So on Wednesday, President Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, appeared before Congress in a much anticipated hearing. And while he was on the stand, a Republican congressman, Representative Mark Meadows of North Carolina, posed a few questions for him about his dealings with Novartis.
So as a reminder, Novartis paid Cohen, you know, who's kind of infamous as being Trump's lawyer and fixer. Novartis paid him $1.2 million for advisory services, and that payment came right before the Trump inauguration.
So let's listen to what Michael Cohen had to say on Wednesday about his dealings with Novartis.
They came to me based upon my knowledge of the enigma Donald Trump.
So arguably, none of this matters. From Novartis's perspective, this was a long time ago. It was under a different CEO, and the company told us in a statement that they consider the matter to be entirely closed. But it must be naggingly annoying to have your name, your brand name, that you've invested all this money and time in building, and you value yourself as a drug maker that's out to cure disease and save patients, to see it evoked by Michael Cohen in this hearing that captivated the national imagination for an entire day, for reasons that probably you don't want your company associated with. For example, hush payments to adult film stars.
Hey, but it was a good day for Stat because Meadows mentioned our story.
True. Thank you, Mark.
Geeky microbiome conferences are typically not the venue where you expect to see gender issues flare up. But that happened this week, didn't it, Rebecca?
That's right. So a microbiome meeting put on by University of California, San Diego, became sort of the subject of a minor controversy this week after the organizers invited only women to speak as presenters at the meeting. That prompted a sort of disapproving opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal titled "No Men Allowed." And it caused such an uproar that the organizers actually changed the language on their website, removing kind of reference to the goals of what they were trying to do.
So as we know very well, and as we've published on, conferences in biotech and science in literally any walk of life have a huge problem with gender parity, which is to say that they tend to be male dominated. So what made people mad about this? Like, what's the problem with having one that's just women?
Yeah, it was interesting because there are a lot of these sort of gender parity initiatives, efforts to get more women on the industry's kind of most prominent stages. But I think this one kind of rankled some people in an unusual way, I think, by the fact that there were no men invited. It was certainly a statement, and that was what one of the organizers told me they were trying to do by sort of overcompensating, by showing that it's possible to have only women make up sort of a compelling, successful conference lineup. But it was interesting to kind of see this play out as a controversy rather than some sort of feel-good gender equity.
We'll be right back.
does it for another episode of the Read Out Loud. Before we go, a quick correction. During our interview last week with breast cancer surgeon Dr. Laura Esserman, I made an error when I referenced a statistic. That statistic didn't have anything to do with genetic testing, but instead referred to the percentage of advanced cancer patients who get genomic testing of their cancers.
So thank you to Hyacinth Abinado, who produced this week's episode.
Matthew Orr and Alyssa Ambrose are our senior producers, and Rick Burke is our executive producer.
So next week marks the 1-year anniversary of this podcast, and to commemorate that, we've been looking back at some of the most memorable segments and interviews from the 52 weeks that precede us. If you have a suggestion for something that was your favorite or that stood out to you, you can email us to readoutloud@statnews.com, and that's also where you can send your feedback, what you liked about this week's episode, what you didn't, how we should pronounce Richard Gonzalez going forward, or anything that strikes your fancy.
And if you like what we do, a regular reminder to please leave a review or rating on Apple Podcasts or whichever platform you use to get your podcasts.
See you next week.